It's Thursday, May 5th, 2005. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be dealing with public hearing on House Bill 5038, which relates to the Department of Human Services, the Health Services Cluster and Division. And we'll begin with some remarks by the Legislative Fiscal Officer that we have, John Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I want to go over the schedule a little bit with everyone so that you're aware of what we're aware of. Today we're going to be working on the Health Services Cluster, which is the largest budget cluster within the Department of Human Services, and I'll have some remarks about that in a moment. Mr. Chair, we received written testimony from the League of Women Voters of Oregon after the hearing was over yesterday. With your permission, we can pass it out and make it part of the official record.
I think that there's no problem. That's
okay.
Do we need any kind of an official?
All right.
We don't need any action.
No.
Other than
no.
Just saying that.
Okay. Next week, we are planning to continue with the health services discussion agency presentation on Monday, and then on Tuesday and Wednesday, public testimony on health services. On Tuesday, we've mapped out time for public testimony on the public health portion of the budget and the mental health budget, and on Wednesday, testimony on the Oregon health plan and related health plan issues.
Okay.
With that, I'll turn to the handout that I put together for the subcommittee. It is our standard LFO memo on phase two materials. I've outlined the agency mission and also listed a chart which is in the LFO analysis, which shows you the major budget components of the health services program, both the general fund and the total funds. And these numbers are all taken from the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07. You'll note, for example, that public health, and this lists the special payments only. It does not list or does not include personal services or S&S. About $16 million of general fund out of a budget of $1.2 billion general fund. And you can see the total funds as well. Obviously, the largest component within health services is the Oregon Health Plan and the Children's Health Insurance Program. About 53% of the general fund budget for health services, about 73% of the total funds budget. I would note that within program support and central admin, there are about 860 positions in the governor's recommended budget, and of that, about 575 are related to public health. So although they have a fairly small portion of general fund with respect to special payments, there is more general fund and federal funds associated with public health that are within program support and central administration. Under major policy and budget issues, we've heard some information already in phase one about the impact of the Medicare Modernization Act, the clawback payment to the federal government, and the transition to Medicare prescription drugs of the dual eligibles. This is of concern to members of the subcommittee and to the general public, and something that we always need to keep in mind. And I think we're going to hear more about it in the health services presentation to us. Healthcare system issues. Financial sustainability in the face of rising costs, an aging population, increased utilization of services. And my comment about what drives care, is it financing, which seems to be a major driver of the kind of care people sometimes get, or is should it be something else, like evidence-based practice or common sense or whatever? But financing within healthcare is a major cost driver and not something that we've sorted out particularly well in the United States so far. mental health and alcohol and drug prevention and treatment, building a system or a continuum of care. I was somewhat surprised, frankly, to read the President's Commission's report on mental health. Several years ago it was produced, and the assertion that many, many people with mental illness can be effectively treated, but to effectively treat them, they need a continuum of care that is appropriate to their circumstances and that meets their needs when they need it. This may be an obvious thing to say, but it certainly wasn't obvious to me, and I think many critics of the mental health system would point out that we don't really have a continuum of care. People don't get the care when they need it at the level that they need it, and this is of concern. And then the proper role of the Oregon State Hospital. As most of you are aware, there is a study being conducted on the Oregon State Hospital. It's received a lot of press. In fact, there was a news report last night on the TV about the Oregon State Hospital. And this study that was funded, phase one of it was funded in the November by the November Emergency Board action, should be completed shortly, and a report issued on phase one is coming on May the 16th. On the initial findings about the role of the Oregon State Hospital within this system or continuum of care. With respect to public health, I've listed the allocation of public funds for prevention versus treatment. If you look at the chart above, it's pretty clear where the dollars go. They go in treatment primarily versus prevention as a major category with respect to the goals of public health. Prevention of illness tends to be, on the whole, fairly low tech. Treatment of illness can be very high tech and very costly. Public health and individual rights. We often look out in the public and see actions that are perhaps we can regard as irresponsible, but the question of passing laws to restrict individual rights in order to protect the public health is always a balancing act, and always we get into concerns about how far should government intervene in the behavior of individuals in order to protect the rest of the public. Flipping over to the next page, I've listed some budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings. House Bill 5030 within 2003 was the primary budget bill for DHS, and it included 8 budget notes related to the health services budget cluster. And I've noted here that the complete texts of those budget notes are found in the budget books, not these, but the actual budget books that are available for you to look at if you'd like.
Where are those books?
The books are in the hearing room, Kat. They're over in the credenza over right over there if you'd like to look at them. The budget notes in House Bill 5030 included directives to DHS to improve and enhance mental health services, particularly those for children and adolescents, to report to the emergency board on a new billing system for psychiatric day treatment providers, encourage the use of combination vaccines and mail order pharmacies in order to reduce the health plan costs, to study the potential for savings related to returning unused prescription drugs to institutional pharmacies, and to analyze the impact of premiums and other cost-sharing mechanisms on the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. Almost all of these budget notes require DHS to report on its activities to the emergency board. There was also a budget note in Senate Bill 5549 directing the department to review and report on the procedures it uses to track other funds' revenue. And Senate Bill 5549 was last session's rebalance bill. And there were some issues with mental health, other funds' revenue, and we directed the department to go back and look at how it's tracking other funds revenue. House Bill 5077 included a directive to DHS to review its management of mental health drug therapies. And the department reported back to the emergency board with some frequency on all of these activities during the interim. Emergency board, in addition to the reports required by the budget note, DHS presented other reports on reducing the cost of administering OHP managed care contracts. This was a requirement not in a budget note, but in House Bill 3624. They reported on using provider tax revenue to support the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. And they reported several times on the status of the forensics population at the Oregon State Hospital, where we were seeing major caseload increases, and there were concerns by emergency board members about that rise in caseload and what was happening out at the Oregon State Hospital. I've noted that the emergency board rebalanced the DHS budget twice in April and November 2004. The Health Services legislatively adopted budget, again, this is the budget that comes out of session, was $4.6 billion total funds, and it included $1.1 billion of general fund. Rebalances and the May 2004 disappropriation reduced the general fund portion of the budget to about $1 billion following the November 2004 rebalance, a decrease of about $84 million general fund. Total funds expenditure limitation, however, remained about the same. And one thing I forgot to include on the emergency board actions is that there were a number of grant requests to apply for federal grants that were approved by the emergency board.
Could you explain why we could reduce by $84 million and still have expenditures remain the same?
Yes. Typically what happens there, and I can't recite all of the changes because they were numerous, but quite often we were seeing, for example, federal funds shifts. That could be part of it, a fund shift. That is to say, we found more federal funding, or it could be provider taxes that are not booked as general fund, but were instead booked as other funds and then matched with federal dollars. But I'd have to go back and really research it more thoroughly.
Well, I think that's a big question. $84 million is a lot of money. If we could reduce it by $84 million, that's either a higher source of revenue through more provider taxes than expected. I mean, whatever it is, that's $84 million. So I'd like to have us know where that came from, because it would be good to see if there's other money there.
We're stretching my memory here, but I think a great deal of that was provider taxes. We got about half of them, the biennium, we had the first 6 months and a year of them, and then I think it was a different match rate, too, potentially. Was that this last biennium? That was the match rate changed a bit. We picked up some money there.
Okay.
We did use less general fund money, but a lot of it was more of less general fund money, but still match money being used. That's why things stayed the same. We managed to shift that money around. It was good use of resources we had. I'm not saying we had a savings $84 million, because that really wouldn't be honest. We shifted money and we had different sources of our money. Was the major thing going on, I think.
I will check that, Mr. Chair. The Secretary of State conducted three audits during the 2003-05 biennium that focused on health services programs, DHS Mental Health and Addiction Services Program, capital and non-capital assets, Oregon State Hospital, and the Oregon State Penitentiary use of overtime, and DHS Medicaid fee-for-service prescription drug costs savings analysis. And I've attached summaries of each audit to this memo, and one audit is currently in the planning stage that I mentioned when we talked about the SPD budget, Medicaid payments to providers. I've also listed one report that hasn't gotten a whole lot of notoriety, but in the fall of 2004, the governor directed DHS to report on the procedures it uses to investigate and prevent abuse at the Oregon State Hospital. And the department produced a report, and then the governor had an independent panel look at that report, and they issued a report of their own on December 3rd. And I've made or listed one quotation. The panel did not observe any pattern of continuing sexual abuse at the hospital. Neither did it find any evidence of failure of the responsible parties to respond promptly and appropriately to allegations nor to follow adopted policy and procedure. However, the panel did identify significant gaps in current policy and procedure. And one question might be, so what has changed? And that would be a good question to ask the department.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Henderson.
Thank you. Was this both ways when we're looking at preventing abuse? What about abuse? Did it go both ways, the patient as well as staff? Was that in the report also?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moss Henderson, I would have to go back and reread the report.
Probably
I think
did.
The focus was primarily on patient abuse. But I would also make the statement that whenever there's patient abuse, it can be in response to violence and so on to staff. Not always, but I think the goal was to make the Oregon State Hospital a safer place for everyone. But I would also, again, ask the department to respond to that at the time, at an appropriate time today.
Actually, you're talking about physical response, and this is talking about sexual abuse.
Well, I understood Senator Moss Henderson to be concerned about abuse,
entire
staff, and potentially patients.
Yeah, I wanted to know if this report included more than just sexual abuse.
I think it did.
Yeah,
yes.
That's it.
Revenue sources. Again, this is a huge Medicaid program. Federal Medicaid revenue, about $2.4 billion. In addition, the cluster's federal revenue consists of children health insurance program funds, alcohol and drug and mental health block grants, a variety of federally funded public health-related grants, including women's, infants, and children's grants, maternal child health block grant, HIV Prevention Project, and Bioterrorism Preparedness and Response Grant Funds. Other funds revenue includes tobacco tax, over $350 million worth, most all of it, but not all of it, going into the Oregon Health Plan, women, infants, and children's infant formula rebates, prescription drug rebates, Oregon Health Plan premiums, what are known as leverage payments from schools, OHSU, and the Oregon Department of Education. And these are instances when these agencies are providing Medicaid services, or at least Medicaid reimbursable services. They send in their other funds or their general funds, and they can be matched with federal Medicaid dollars, and all of it sent back to these respective agencies and institutions. Third-party recoveries and a variety of public health fees. One final note that the governor's budget includes about $7.8 million of dedicated lottery funds that are used for gambling, addiction, and treatment programs. General fund represents about 25% of the cluster's overall revenue.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Britton, what percent of the lottery revenue would that $7.8 million represent?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I believe it is dedicated in statute at 1%, I believe. I smile because I can't always remember whether it's 1% or 2%.
I believe it's 1%.
It's 1%.
It's 1%, if I remember right.
That'll be an underestimate of what comes in.
The governor's recommended budget for health services is $4.8 billion total funds, about $1.2 billion of general funds. Total funds increase of about 4% compared to the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget through November 2004, but includes a 16% increase in general fund. And the primary reason for that is the loss of, or the lower match rate, federal match rate, associated with Medicaid. Back in the spring of 2003, the federal government passed the Tax Relief Act of 2003, and this gave the state of Oregon about $200 million of additional Medicaid revenue in lieu of what would have been general fund. About 100 of it went into the Department of Human Services budget over both the 2001-03 biennium, about a quarter's worth, and four quarters, or 1 year's worth, went into the 2003-05. But that tax relief measure ended, and consequently there was the backfilling of that lost federal revenue with general fund in the governor's budget.
Could you clarify, even if you just said it, because it didn't seem
sure,
as to why we have a 16% increase in general funds on a budget that's only a 4% increase over the prior biennium?
Again, Mr. Chair and members, I think it's primarily this fund shift related to Medicaid, that there was an enhanced federal match provided for in the Tax Relief Act of 2003. Okay. And the Tax Relief Act covered five calendar quarters beginning in April of 2003. So the 2001-03 budget picked up some additional federal dollars, and we probably used the general fund that was freed up for the rebalance in 2001-03. The 2003-05 biennium picked up a full year, four quarters worth of this enhanced match. And that was, it was a significant significant match change. All in all, for those five quarters, it amounted to almost $100 million within the DHS budget over those five calendar quarters.
Now, is that, when you say the match rate change, you're talking about from 60-40 to 62-39 or 61.8?
As I recall, it was about a 295 basis points, 2.95%, which is a significant amount of dollars, about $100 million over five quarters.
And what will be the change in match rate for the next biennium?
Well,
or is it going to be the same?
No, Mr. Chair. The enhanced match rate is gone after those five quarters, but
okay.
The point is that you then...
you're talking about enhanced, not based on poverty level.
No, it is not based on the per capita income level. It was an enhancement given to all states.
Will there be a change in the match rate for Oregon based on poverty or income?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. There are estimates now of the matching rate that should be incorporated in the departmental reshoot for the next biennium. They already know what the match rate is for the current federal fiscal year, and I believe the next federal fiscal year, but we pick up about 3 months, as I recall, of the following, or the following federal, I think 9 months actually, of the following federal fiscal year.
So is the federal match based on income projected for 1 to 2 years in the future?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. Yes, that's my understanding, is that they are making estimates on Oregon's relative per capita income compared to other states.
And has that, do you know what that rate is for the next 2 years as compared to the current?
Mr. Chair, I know it, but I don't have it with me. I can get it for you, though. and show you what the match rates are for each of the federal fiscal years. And there are three federal fiscal years that will go into the 03-05 or the 05-07 biennium.
Okay.
But we will see, I think, a small change in the reshoot based on new information since the governor's budget was developed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
The change we saw here for those five quarters was very dramatic. We do see little changes every 3 years, and it's, you know, it's a fraction of a percentage point usually. I'd be surprised if we saw a huge change. This was really an anomaly for five quarters, and the reason was the entire country is in a huge recession. States couldn't make a general fund match for the Medicaid program. Congress, at the federal level, said we are changing the match rates across the nation on a very temporary basis to help states out to maintain their Medicaid program. That's what we saw. So we have this artificial, we're at this level, boom, we jump way up, which means for a less amount of general fund, we get to maintain a program. The way I think of it, it's very simplistic, but I think this way, if you've got $100 is what your program costs you to run, and you used to have to pay $40 of it, and the feds paid $60, all of a sudden, we were paying $38, and they were paying the difference, and that percentage point difference is $100 million or $200 million. Now we're back down to our usual regular rate, and it also makes it more difficult because it's for five quarters, and the federal government has a different fiscal year than we do. So you're just bouncing these numbers around until you kind of figure out where you're at. But my memory was it was about a $200 million change in favor of our particular state and more than other states. And that's my memory of this. And now we're back to our baseline, and that's why we see this increase. If we like to maintain the program, we see this increase in general fund. Other funds have to be made up to get the match.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Winters.
Good morning. Senator Bates is correct. It was $200 million.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, it was $200 million for the overall state. It was about $100 million for DHS. And an additional $100 million, it was split about half and half for all states in terms of their enhancement of Medicaid. The other $100 million did not have particular strings attached and could be used elsewhere in the budget. The governor's recommended budget includes a number of reductions to health services, and it attempts to quantify the impact of the Medicare Modernization Act. And with respect to the MMA, the governor's budget assumes, and it should read, the passage, not message. Whoever wrote this was asleep, I guess. Passage of Senate Bill 88 or a similar piece of legislation. And then I've listed some of the more significant reductions within public health. Reduces the Family Planning Expansion Program by $1.6 million general fund, $17.5 million total funds. It has a 9-to-1 match rate. It eliminates three drinking water inspection positions, assumes that about $10 million of dedicated tobacco tax is redirected from the tobacco prevention and education programs into the Oregon Health Plan payment budget. And this action would require legislative action. And something that we did during the 03-05 building of the budget, but this does require some legislative action to do. It adds 500.
Mr. Chair. Senator Moss
Anderson. I was wondering, has there been a report on the increase of tobacco use since we keep decreasing the tobacco prevention education programs? I know that it had been highly effective with youth, and at least in the 90s, and we keep taking out and taking out. I guess that's something to ask the department when they're up here.
We can bring up.
Within the public health budget, the governor's budget adds $500,000 of general fund to expand the number of counties from 14 to 19 with school-based health clinics. Within the Oregon Health Plan payments budget
Chair,
component,
I'm going to go back. I'm not sure. Did you ask a question there? I mean, there's two policy issues here that we're just kind of skipping over, and I want to make sure we're very clear about these. One is the family planning. Family Planning Expansion Program. Was that an error of the governor's original budget of not funding that, the $1.6 million? It's a 9-to-1 match. It's one of the key things for preventing teenage pregnancies. This is not an abortion program. This is a program that prevents pregnancies and gets people through their family planning. John?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, I will let the budget and management analyst answer that when it comes to her presentation. My understanding is that the governor had hoped to fund that, but in the end it was not funded. It was cut by the $1.6 million general fund.
Where's your second question?
Second question is about the tobacco, the
current
money. That takes action by the House and the Senate to make that change occur, and I'm pretty sure that's something that people have voted on in this state several times. That is not something that we should just sort of pass over. These are two very important issues. I think you've highlighted them, John, and I appreciate that. But I think just letting it kind of slip through here is something we need to make right up front known. This is something we have to look at very carefully. Okay.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, for sure, the only remark I would make is that if we did not take the $10 million, we would need to, if you want to keep the services as they are in the Oregon Health Plan, you've got a hole of $10 million.
And I fully understand that. We talk about prevention, and then we do.
I know.
This is contrary thinking.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject quickly into these two issues. On the $1.6 million on the family planning, that's a reduction of the expansion. How big of a reduction of the expansion is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, this is not the program may be a misnomer. This was not an expansion per se. It was an expansion on the part of the federal government. This is Medicaid. It is an enhanced match. The overall program, as I recall, and I'd have to go back to my analysis, but I think this is about a 33% decrease in funding for that overall program. So the $1.6 million general fund and associated match is about a third, but I could be wrong. I'd have to go back and look.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the tobacco dedication, the dedication of the tobacco tax, the irony is when we're cutting a program that's been voted on by the people, and then at the same time we're failing to go back to the voters with the 10-cent tax, cigarette tax that collapsed through the measure 30 referral. When we say we have a hole to backfill, there's a pretty basic simple way to get that hole filled. Would that bring in a lot more than $10 million?
Good point.
Of course, the rub is that the people voted for both of those.
And fortunately, as elected officials, we get to decide what the people told us through the two votes. And I think they told us they didn't like income taxes much.
That's right.
I think it wasn't very. The second vote was not very explicit about cigarettes. I think we know where the public stands on the cigarette tax. Every poll puts it at 70, 80, or 90%.
Should have never been put in that tax bill.
Agreed.
Mr. Chair and members, continuing with the Oregon Health Plan payments, there are a variety of fee-for-service reductions and efficiencies within the governor's budget, and the agency can talk a little bit more about those on Monday. There's the aggressive enforcement of the state's preferred drug list through prior authorization. There's the elimination within the OHP Plus benefit package for adults of vision and dental benefits, and these are adults other than pregnant women. There is a limit on the number of days a hospital is reimbursed for OHP Plus recipients. Eliminate certain
fees. Is it plus or?
Actually, I think it's for all.
Okay. It's fee-for-service. It's all in fee-for-service.
Yes.
Yeah.
Eliminate certain fee-for-service inflationary reimbursement adjustments. it assumes that the hospital cost component within the managed care capitation rate is 90% of the actuarially determined cost rather than 100%. Today, that percentage is about 72%. It reduces the OHP budget for several reductions made in the seniors and people with disability budget. Most of the persons, well, all of the persons receiving Medicaid long-term care, the programs that you've heard about over the last week or so, also are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Adds a net general fund increase of $2.5 million for the Medicare Modernization Act. With respect to what are known as non-OHP payments, and these...
On the $2.5 million, was that for... staff, or what is needed from general fund for MMA?
It is a result, the net result of the clawback payment, the savings to the Medicaid program, a variety of things, and they're outlined in my analysis. But it's the overall net result of all of that.
Okay, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In our discussions with FPD earlier, when we talked about the general fund or the general assistance program being eliminated, that's one of the several reductions that affect this budget. And yet the testimony was that there's a presumed eligibility. And I would like to highlight for a discussion whether that savings actually exists, because I still, at least I don't understand how it can exist if there's presumed eligibility, unless people aren't being told they have presumed eligibility, or there's something amiss there, and I'd like to get it explained before we move too far down the road.
Well,
or during this
Mr.
process.
Chair and Representative Hanson, I did talk to the department about that very issue. There are savings assumed in the governor's budget with respect to Oregon Health Plan benefits for the general assistance population. And those reductions are really in two places, within the Oregon Health Plan and within staffing costs. There is a small reduction related to the $300 grant for general assistance. But as I understand from the department, those savings that are in the health plan and potentially within the field structure as well are not real. They are because, as we heard testimony on, there is presumptive eligibility here, that there is an initial screening of someone who comes in for general assistance, whether or not there is a cash grant given to them. That piece of the program could be eliminated, and it is eliminated in the governor's budget. Nonetheless, if a person is applying for SSI, the field will do an initial eligibility screening, and if it appears that this person will ultimately become eligible for SSI or for SSDI, those people are eligible starting right then for the Oregon Health Plan. So when general assistance is reduced, again, this is my understanding, and I'd ask the department to clarify or correct me, there is not savings associated in the health plan necessarily or within the field structure. But they can clarify that for you, Mr. Chair. With respect to non-OHP payments, and these are payments for Medicare premiums for eligible persons, this also, starting in the 05-07 biennium, includes the clawback payment of $97.7 million. So when you look at 03-05 compared to 05-07 in this particular budget category, you're going to see a major increase. And it's the result of the clawback. It is also the result of higher Medicare premiums. We purchased Medicare coverage for a number of eligible persons so that Medicare becomes the payer of first resort. I'm flipping.
Are you aware of any, this may be a question I need to ask, but are you aware of any movement in health care providers who provide Medicare supplement that will fill the gap for prescriptions that will now move into Medicare.
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer you ask the department that one. That's a tough one. I know that there is a role, and I know that that role is changing for supplemental insurers for Medicare prescription drugs.
My sense is, and that's just my sense, I can't answer this for sure because nobody knows, when that program rolls out, which will probably in January for most of the Medicare patients, there are holes in that program, and it looks like some people are in the pharmaceutical industry, not manufacturers, but people who insure for this, are looking at possible supplemental programs that people can buy for that.
You know, as an attorney, and somebody brought me their policy, I'd be looking to see what the wording is, to see if the wording coordinates with benefits and says we will supplement the benefits provided under Medicare Act such and such as amended, because there may be benefits that are in Medicare supplement policies that were not intended at the time the policy was sold merely because of the general effect of the wording, and the contract wording will provide. That'll be an interesting view.
You are an attorney, sir.
Watching out for the client.
But you know, you're right. Oh. You're right. There could be, the word benefits could be construed probably to mean that now that we have a benefit, which is a pharmaceutical benefit, yeah, that's not a complete benefit, that maybe this supplement insurance covers that.
There'll be a number of insurance companies that will go back and say,
they may be looking at it pretty carefully.
I'm on my last page here. With respect to mental health and addiction services, the governor's budget implements delays to inflationary reimbursement adjustments for providers for 6 months. It reduces funding for alcohol and drug treatment and prevention services, reduces some community mental health and crisis services funding. It includes $6 million total funds, $4.7 million general fund, for enhancements to the mental health program. $3 million of the $6 million reflects the roll-up costs of projects approved by the emergency board at its meeting last November, including $350,000 general fund for phase two of the Oregon State Hospital study. To help you, I've attached the...
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, could you look into the issue for us? I mean, we don't need to do it now, but of maintenance of effort in our A&D programs.
We'd also like to ask that question to the department when it's up here. Mr. Nickel will be up. We can ask him those questions, I think.
Representative Hanson, I'll do that. I noted in my analysis that they could have some issues. They have had issues both with the mental health block grant and the alcohol and drug block grant with maintenance of effort, and had negotiations with the federal government about those things. Anyway, the LFO analysis is attached for your benefit, as well as the three audits related to health services from the Secretary of State that I mentioned a moment ago. With that, I turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you. One more question. John, I wanted to wait until you finish your summation, which I appreciate. I don't know how you keep all this in your head and go through it, because I certainly couldn't. Thank you. One of the audits I'm most interested in is not mentioned here, and that's an audit we've tried for 3 years to get done on the fee-for-service side of pharmaceuticals. It is common in commercial plans that commercial plans have a pharmaceutical benefit manager, and then they audit that manager on a regular basis. There's companies actually the auditing for them. It's very complex. The state situation with fee-for-service is a little different because we have this discount program. But it still needs to be managed and carefully looked at. There's money set aside by the pharmaceutical industry that may not have been tapped that we should have gotten, or we may have gotten appropriately. We've battled for 3 years to get a regular program of audits set up. Ultimately, it was turned over to the Secretary of State's office to do. We warned them that we thought they were inappropriate for doing them. We thought it should have gone directly to a private organization as an outside source. They put out an RFP, which nobody accepted. Finally put an RFP out that people did accept, and we're still waiting for that audit to be done. It's now the third year of asking for that audit. Do we know where that audit is? And if we don't know, can we find out what the status of it is as we go through this testimony the next day or two?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, your recollection of the history is accurate. At least it's consistent with mine, and I apologize for not including that. It is an audit that is underway right now, and my understanding is it should be completed fairly soon. But I will check with the Secretary of State and find out how soon.
Thank you, John.
The last page of the packet, have you seen this yet?
And that's a different audit.
Okay.
That's not the audit we're looking for. And the potential savings with this are potentially huge or none. We don't know. Commercial carriers find significant savings when they go back and audit their managers. But we're in a kind of a different environment with the state with these deep discounts we get on the fee-for-service side of this. So we're not sure what we're looking at yet.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Britton before we get into the public testimony portion? Okay. I'd like to begin with Pam Keschner. You could review with us the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division overview this cluster.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I am Pam Teschner, and I'm from the Department of Administrative Services, and I have a brief handout that Mr. Britton is distributing right now. Again, this is something that is our standard format as well, as John mentioned with his, and you have seen these first couple of pages now. This is the fourth time, at least. So, looking at page 4, what I have for you is a brief, very high-level summary of basically what Mr. Britton has just presented. And so this is just to highlight some of those again. Health Services Cluster is the largest cluster in the Department of Human Services, making up half of the total funds budget, as you can see in that pie chart on page 4. In that cluster, there are three major program areas. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs makes up the greatest chunk of that. About 80% of the cluster's budget is in that program area, and most of that is OHP and the Children's Health Insurance Program. The fifth page shows graphically how the total funds budget for health services splits out by fund type, and the other funds portion is about 18%, most of that being tobacco tax, roughly $350 million of tobacco tax, and also the second largest piece of the other funds money is from provider taxes of roughly $180 million. The federal funds piece, again, is most of that, nearly all of that is Medicaid, but there is some roughly $50 million coming in for the Children's Health Insurance Program. Then page 6 takes that same $4.8 billion total funds budget and just shows you how it breaks out by what we call budget categories. And as you can see, 91% of the money is going out in special payments, which are going out to the local community provider payments. So that's in this agency, that is typical across the entire agency where most of the money is going out to the local community. The next page, 7, it does show you historically how this budget has changed over time. And as I mentioned last time with the seniors and people with disabilities budget, our column for the 0305 legislatively approved budget doesn't exactly match up with Mr. Britton's and his analysis because he includes through the November e-board and we do not. So you won't be able to match back to his numbers. But what is significant here, as you can see, is the increase in general funds. And there was a good discussion about that explains that increase from the federal monies that were received prior and that now are no longer here, and so we replace that with general fund. Yes,
Senator Winters.
Back on page 6 in your pie chart, included in special payments, where would I find the payments to, like, DAS and the Attorney General's Office, in which one of these categories?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you would find that in the...
Personal services?
No, that would be in services and supplies.
Services and supplies.
So it would be that little sliver there, the 3%. There is one thing I want to point out on page 7 in that table. The positions and full-time equivalent for the governor's budget 0507 isn't the reality. There was a miscalculation in putting those numbers together, which will be corrected in the reshoot, and so there's really 140 too many positions in that 2,378. So it's actually a little over 2,200, so there isn't as a significant increase as it would appear. So that was an error, and it is being corrected.
Go over that again, give me the numbers.
The number in the positions in the column for the 0507 governor's budget, you'll see the
yes.
positions at 2,378. Well, that's 142 high. So if you subtract that off, you end up with 2,238. And that increase...
42, so wouldn't that be 36?
142. It was 140.
Too high.
Too high. Sorry. Yes, it's 140 positions.
Okay, got it.
Too high.
Too high.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the increase in position is much less than what it would appear. So again, that was an error, and that is being corrected. Page 8 outlines at a much higher summary level the major budget drivers and policy issues that Mr. Britton has gone through. Again, the Medicare Modernization Act. I also have a little bit more information on the next page about that. Growth in the Oregon Health Plan, which is a result both of increased medical costs, that continued escalation, as well as caseload growth in the OHP plus population. And we've talked about the mental health infrastructure and the needs that are there due to the overcrowding issues. So in the governor's budget, there were a number of policy packages. These three were the larger packages included. And again, there were two packages, as Mr. Britton pointed out, for the Medicare Modernization Act implementation. And those two packages net to an increase of $2.5 million general fund. But an overall savings of about $200 million of total funds. There is in the governor's budget an investment in the Oregon State Hospital to help address the overcrowding issues, and this investment is about $4.7 million for planning for the future and to look at community-based resources. There's also a package that, again, has been discussed already to some degree to restore a restricted benefit package for the standard population through provider taxes. This will be funded entirely with other funds and federal funds. And there is no general fund that will be going into that program. And the provider tax, as you probably recall, was approved in House Bill 2747. The last page highlights the major reductions to the general fund, major reductions basically, but these I show in parentheses impact to the general fund. And again, as has been mentioned, the tobacco settlement funds will be used to address needs in the general fund. The Oregon Health Plan managed care rates for hospital services, instead of bringing them up to 100% of cost, the governor's budget brings them to 90% of cost, and that's for the DRG hospital component. And so that realized a savings of a little over $17 million. And there are various fee-for-service reductions totaling about $16 million of general fund. And then in order to reduce the general fund and gather savings, you have to look at the Oregon Health Plan, and rather than reducing the population, what is included in the budget is a reduction of benefit with an effort to try to maintain the current population that's covered. And so the dental and vision benefit was eliminated for the Oregon Health Plan plus adults, with the exception of pregnant women. And so the savings is about $14 million. Now, there was pointed out the Family Planning Expansion Program reduction of $1.6 million, which, yes, in fact, was done inadvertently. It was an error, and so you'll see that coming back, that $1.6 million. I believe you'll see that in the reshoot. And, yes, from what I remember as well, it was roughly a 30% reduction to that program. That was an unintended reduction, and so there you'll see that $1.6 million most likely coming back through the reshoot. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. If not, the department will go into further detail on these.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. If we now could have the presentation from Human Services, Mr. Hess. I think they need to be passed out. As you begin, I'd like to refer to the information that was provided to me by email last night and is being handed out right now. It basically gives us a kind of the same information that's available elsewhere put in one place. And it's not detailed enough for me. It does not. It just gives me lump categories. I mean, I look at family health, and it's $193 million. And yet it's the components, and Cindy, you need to be listening to this, the components of this family health category is not broken out for me. And so this is as high level as I can get just by going to other things that have been provided for us already. And so it's not as useful to me as I had hoped it would be, because the goal was for us to receive information on programs showing what programs cost, not categories that contain, you know, huge numbers of programs. For instance, I don't have any clue what WIC costs. I don't know about family planning and the other subcomponents of this. I would like to have us have the information as to what these programs cost. And is that a difficult thing to provide to us?
Mr. Chairman, Barry Cass, Assistant Director for Health Services. We can provide that information to the committee in any level of detail that you would find helpful.
I would assume that it's on your computers, and so for these, you know, I'm not going to cancel today. I'm tempted to cancel today because of the same reasons that I did it before with CAF, and that is we're going to get an overview when we're in phase two, and this is not valuable in trying to actually determine budgets if we don't have financial data on which to base these things. But we'll go ahead with today. But I would like to have additional information this afternoon so that tonight we can review the finances so that we don't have to schedule additional hearings. If you would please give us more detailed information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will make that available this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Now, if I understand, you want we want detail by sub-programs within each of these priority categories that are described on the spreadsheet that you're looking for.
Correct. Thank you. What the programs cost, not what categories or clusters of programs cost. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I said, I'm Barry Cass, the Assistant Director for Health Services. We thought we would pursue this two-day presentation in the same order that we presented Phase 1, public health followed by mental health followed by OMAP. With the time remaining today, I'm hopeful that we can get significantly into the mental health and addictions budget.
Okay.
We had come today with the intent of responding to the instructions that you provided to us for Phase 2, and unless you direct otherwise, we will come to the spreadsheet at the end to describe each of these programs and how those budgets relate. But given your comments just now, that may not be the most helpful
approach
today.
Well, I'd like to focus first on the things that you, from our prior discussions, you think that we need to zero in on, and then as questions come up, we can.
Very good. As I mentioned in February, the public health program has a new director of public health who has joined us only in mid-March, and I wanted to use this hearing as an opportunity to introduce to you, Mr. Chairman, and to the committee, Dr. Susan Allen, who is our new public health director. And I assume that later in the session you will be seeing her in this seat or alongside of me, but at this point we're in midstream, and I thought it would be best to maintain as much continuity as possible. We are delighted to have Dr. Allen join us. Dr. Allen is highly trained both in public health, as a physician, and as an attorney. and has 20 years of continuous service in Arlington, Virginia, and is involved in many national initiatives in public health, and I'm really delighted that she's here.
We're delighted as well. Thank you for joining the team. We're looking forward to working with you very closely.
And sitting next to Dr. Allen, if you'll indulge me, is Dr. Catherine Bradley, who is a doctoral nurse, comes to us from Oregon Health and Science University and runs our family health program, and was not in Oregon during our February hearings. And to correct an oversight, in the room in February, Gail Shibley, who runs our Office of Public Health Systems, which we'll be talking about in some detail following your priority questions. Gail Shibley is right here. And I apologize to Gail for the oversight in February. Some of you may not know that Gail was at one time a legislator in the House of Representatives here in the state of Oregon. I also want to say, in response to that interesting presentation from John Britton, it really does call out the key issues that we're struggling with, including, remarkably, the role of prevention and its relationship to treatment as a budgetary question, the system for mental health and the relative role and operation of the state hospital, which has become a major concern for everyone, and the complexity of health care delivery and how it's financed, and how public policy can be influenced through that financing mechanism. Our first section is on public health, and just to recap, there are 5 public health offices. All of them are now supervised by Dr. Bradley. Within public health, Mr. Chairman, there are over...
Wait a second.
I'm sorry. Dr. Allen.
I was going to say, congratulations. You've just been promoted. Dr. Allen's going to be running for office.
Maybe there's something going on that I don't know. Within those 5 offices, there are over 100 cost centers, which is, I think, the complexity that you're going to see when you receive the additional information that you've just requested. Mm-hmm. Public health is really a construct of a number of individual programs which, taken together, create the whole picture. And we've tried to present the whole picture because during the last session, when we presented the fragments, it wasn't communicated well. So we're in a dilemma with public health. Public health is a series of tiles in a large mosaic, and I hope we can communicate both the integrity of each of those programs and also the effectiveness of the whole process.
You know, I realize it is really challenging. By giving the breakdown, it allows the committee, to those that want to look at the 100 and see if there's areas that need to be questioned, not to go through a detailed look at all of the 100.
Yes,
it's a spot audit opportunity, actually.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just to illustrate that, we have programs from prenatal care all the way to indigent burial within public health. We license tanning beds on the one hand, which is a very, very small component of the budget and fee-based, and the WIC program, which is unlimited and huge and serves tens of thousands of women and over 130,000 children. So it's a complex area, and I hope we can communicate that. And while there are gaps, and we have highlighted some of them for you in the last 2 interims, we do have the framework of a comprehensive public health program, and the purpose of that program is to assure the conditions in which Oregonians can be healthy. It's not a program that forces people to be healthy, but we're trying to promote responsible behavior and protect people from the hazards that are out there, whether it's an infectious disease or an environmental hazard. In that connection, you asked some questions about the Office of Public Health Systems. It was one of the priorities with the widest divergence on the committee of priority within the committee. And I wanted to just to flesh out a little bit what that office is about. The environmental health program for the state is designed to protect Oregonians from hazards that exist around them. There's often some confusion, Mr. Chairman, between the Department of Environmental Quality and its responsibilities, which are essentially to protect the environment from us, and public health, which is there to protect us from hazards in the environment. And Gail Shibley is responsible for that program. It includes radiation protection, food safety. We license hospitals and other health services. We manage the state's trauma system and our emergency medical system. Those kinds of programs are largely regulatory in nature. They're generally based on fees. We do have a drinking water program, which is a combination of fees and federal EPA money with a little bit of general fund to make sure that our drinking water is safe. Those are the kinds of services that are included in that priority.
Okay, there's recent reports of potential risk in the war on terror of availability of isotope or radioactive materials in hospitals. I mean, reports that there may be scouting or of hospitals to see if those items could be, you know, captured or made available or something like that. Is this department also responsible for that, or would that be an overlap with Homeland Security?
Mr. Chairman, we work closely with Homeland Security. There is a public health preparedness program, and Dr. Allen can join us at the table for a more detailed discussion. But all of the offices within public health, including the laboratory, are involved in the response, potential response to a terrorist event, and we work in cooperative in cooperation with Beth Stilwell and the Office of Homeland Security in planning that. And Dr. Grant Higginson, who has been our public health officer, has represented the department on the Governor's Security Council and worked closely with Homeland Security.
Thank you.
I want to draw your attention to the Phase 2 document in your... Now, I don't know what you have in front of you, but in my book, it's the red tab behind public health. And I know that keeping us in the proper place in the book is an essential concern. The document, Mr. Chairman, details numerous factors.
Pardon me?
Are we there?
We're there. Page 1 says major budget drivers and environmental
factors. That's it. That's exactly right. And this section, which is quite lengthy, details a number of factors that are affecting public health and its evolution, including emerging infections. And during the past several years, we've seen things like SARS and West Nile virus that have caused alarm, and which we have a systematic response to. Health disparities, which is a which reflects the fact that different populations express diseases in different ways and at different rates, and that they are affected by a variety of factors that public health can respond to. Access to care has become an issue. What's one of the purposes of public health is to assure access for populations that have no other vehicle, and we work closely with the primary care community in working to establish safety net clinics and make sure that people who don't have the opportunity to be insured have some access to care when they need it.
Answering something about that,
please.
You know, I'm working with some of the clinics, like in Medford, you have Clinica del Valle, and just the safety net clinics. And the president and the federal administration has placed a focus and emphasis on pouring more money into such community clinics. But in the presentations that we've had, as I've tried to learn what's going on in the last couple of months, I'm not seeing a lot of coordination between the medical services provided under the Oregon Health Plan and the safety net clinics. And I'm wondering, are these siloed, or is there close coordination between the federal money and the federal benefits and what we provide? As they provide more, does that affect us providing or making any adjustment in the things that we do?
Mr. Chairman, that's a complicated question. I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer it, but in many cases, those community-based clinics are located in public health, local health departments, and there is coordination at that level. While the Medicaid funded Oregon Health Plan may be working through other avenues, there is an effort at the local level to coordinate care. But it is one of our goals, and it hasn't been achieved yet.
Okay, they depend heavily on OHP payments, I mean, as you know, provider payments and so forth, and my understanding is that they also service and a community that are uninsured and uneligible or ineligible for other programs. And I'm just wondering about, you know, are there meetings between DHS people and the federal government and as far as money that's going into these community-based clinics? I'm just wondering how closely aligned things that the federal government is doing in that regard and the state's policy division.
Mr. Chairman, I can't respond comprehensively, but I do know that part of the federal policy now is to work directly with clinics at the local level, make those awards based on applications that come from the local level. The state is aware of them. We participate. Our staff, in fact, in public health, we have a health planning section. What's left of that, it was reduced after the last session. But it does work with local communities to establish those clinics. So we're at least trying to facilitate a safety net that can respond to people who don't have access to care otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Our school-based health centers, for example, are an effort in that on behalf of the building of a safety net for young people.
See, now that's the same kind of question. Is there a coordination between where we base school-based health clinics and the availability of community safety net clinics?
Mr. Chairman, there is. We would like to see school-based clinics everywhere in the state. We have 14 counties covered now. We'll have 19 if this governor's proposal is adopted. We invest a very small amount of money in establishing those school-based clinics, and then they are, as they're functional and meet all criteria and have a certification, they're eligible for reimbursement from private sources, insurance programs, as well as Medicaid funds. So I think there is a coordination there to try to create an entity which can deliver services and be self-sustaining.
Well, good. Then when someone speaks on the three additional locations, I would like to answer the question, are these three locations where there are no community safety net clinics, or are there other areas where there is not a community safety net clinic and there's also not a school-based clinic that might have been a better selection, so that we can try and have a resource for the poor to get treatment in as broad a regional area as possible? So I'm just not sure how we came about the selection of these three locations.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Wynn,
along that line, is there existing someplace a long-range plan for not only the development of school-based clinics but also the safety net, so that, one, if I'm looking ahead, that I, as a legislator, we can start planning. We know maybe we can get three this session and where they are based on need. Is there a plan someplace?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I'm not sure there is a single document that would tell you a long-range strategy for the safety net, but we have, in some places, we've actually been losing capacity, not gaining it. So we're working to support local efforts that represent a community sponsorship. That for example, in there are about 22 federally qualified health centers now in the state of Oregon.
I guess mine is taking it. Follow-up. Mine is taking it where, as a state, is there someone within your organization that is responsible for planning for these kinds of needs, irrespective of the federal dollar strings or the general fund dollar strings, so where we have in place based on needs within inside of our communities? That's my question.
This is directly in line with what I'm saying. Is there somebody in our state who's actually saying we have health clinics that are going in, we have federal money coming in for safety net clinics, we have a need to assure that there's availability of services all across the state in rural and urban areas? Is where should we be putting the pins rather than just having them? I mean, are they just happening or are they being systematically approached? And then Senator Bates, after you answer that, and then Senator Bates.
Mr. Chairman,
let you answer the question.
Pardon? Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, there are people individually responsible. With respect to school-based health centers, Dr. Bradley and Bob Nystrom have a plan for the development of school-based health clinics in this state. And we have special grants and dedicated funds that we're managing and working with local communities to make that an equitable and growing program. In the office of the state public health officer, we have a health planning section which works with the Primary Care Association, local health departments, and others to expand access to care and take advantage of funding sources when they arise. And they also work closely with the with Bruce Goldberg and the Office of Health Planning and Research. So, yes, we have leadership there, and we can bring them to you to discuss how that has developed, what its opportunities are, and also areas where we're frustrated in the development of the safety net.
Okay. I have to check our schedule before we can do that, but I'm very interested, and maybe we won't be able to get to that before this session's over, but it certainly is very important to us to know what the long-term plan is for access. Senator Bates, and then Representative Hanna.
This is a discussion that, you know, when I think of the time we spent in this committee on other issues and the amount of money involved in this kind of a program and the number of people it touches, I wish we'd had more time for this discussion because this is really germane. You mentioned Dr. Goldberg was, of course, what I was going to go to. He's been a real driver of this program. These are primarily, and I think rightly so, community-based and community-driven programs. I think the local communities have a much better idea of what is needed and where that need is geographically than the state does. This is one of those times, I think, that what's been happening in our communities is extremely important with assistance from the state, but not the state mandating where those centers should go. We have expanded the number of federally qualified centers, which is important because those centers then for Medicaid-eligible people are reimbursed at cost, not a discounted rate. The other part of that is that the community health centers, as well as the centers inside the schools, have now gone from a point of thinking that we are going to give a service which is not going to be reimbursed other than by donations and what the state can supply, but they've got into a full situation where they actually bill patients when they have appropriate funds to do so they can be more self-sustaining. And that's a big change for those people. I'm also seeing the health centers in our schools going first now to those schools that need the most. In our community would be the schools in West Medford as an example, in Eagle Point. And it's good to see those going in the areas of greatest need first now and not necessarily those areas where kids may have more access outside the school. So we've seen a shift in the last two or three years.
Actually, I think one of the three that are promoted here or proposed is for a new school in an area that is not known for being needy. So that's why I'm actually bringing up
that.
That should be
a question, because what I've seen in our local community is just the opposite of that. I'm glad to see the way it's gone. Dr. Goldberg has been a real driver, along with public health, to get these programs up and running. And frankly, when you look at health care delivery systems, it is probably one of the areas we can point to with some pride. I'm concerned about our loss of capacity in it, but that's at the one area where we've done a pretty good job of giving health care at a very cost-effective basis.
You know, what you bring up, though, it kind of clarifies something, and that is that we're talking about two aspects. One is the availability of resources to pay for health care, and the other is the resources to provide the health care. And so the OHP provides the coverage. It's like a state insurance policy, essentially. It provides the money, but that's not of much value if there aren't health providers
Absolutely.
That are prepared to actually
Absolutely.
Do the work. And so we're looking at the availability of resources to fund and also to provide the service. But yet they are coordinated, or there needs to be coordination there. Senator Wentz?
Mr. Chair, I raise that because I still heard someone ultimately has to put pieces together. And I'm not hearing that. I get frustrated because we talk in terms of I own this piece and somebody owns this piece and somebody owns that piece, and I support communities and community development, but somehow all these pieces have to be brought together, and that's why I raised the question, do we have somewhere in our state system, and if we don't, maybe we need to look at having the ability to do some planning for health care in the state of Oregon. We've all talked about it, and we can still continue to talk whether the horse comes first, the cart comes last, but I submit that until we do get a roadmap put together, we're going to continue to do what we're doing, and it'll be by gosh and by golly.
Well, certainly, this is an issue that if we identify, then we can focus on and see, you know, maybe it's being done just as part of job assignment, but we're just not aware of it.
We just thought
so we need to.
So
I think a lot of it's being done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we need to ask somebody.
Okay. Based on that discussion, if there's anything, any comments you'd like to make, that'd be fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Higginson is just whispering in my ear that that is precisely the role of the Office of Health Policy. And they are pursuing this, and the Commission has a special committee that's working on this. But I must say that from the perspective of the Department and our public health effort, we do have at least two significant focuses with people responsible. And unfortunately, during the last 3 years when we were cutting the budget, one of the things that did get did get reduced was health planning. Now, fortunately, that's being strengthened through the Dr. Goldberg's office, and I think that leadership has been very helpful. And we do have staff that have been moving back and forth. So I think there is an infrastructure, if you will, of that kind of planning. But I can't tell you that it's complete.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the interim, I had the pleasure to serve on the Safety Net. Governor's task force on safety net clinics, and we did a great deal of work in pretty mundane in terms of definitions and inventories and that, but it laid a good basis for the next step of the plan. But I think there was maybe some of the discomfort is that the planning might not be moving ahead fast enough, but this was to lay a good framework under Dr. Goldberg, and so I think we're going to be making probably some pretty decent progress as we move to the next step.
All right, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. One of the significant trends that I wanted to bring to your attention is precisely in this area where public health has historically been understood as a preventive program. We deal with emerging infections, we immunize people, and so forth. We have seen over the last decade a transformation in the local health departments, increasingly to a provider focus. And I think it's precisely because the safety net process is becoming more critical. And also, that's where the revenue is. The revenue in this department is in the provision of direct care, not in the provision of prevention. If you look at the document that Mr. Britton provided, about 1.25% of the department's general fund revenue is vested in public health, and about half of that is in direct care services, such as prenatal care and the like. So our effort in prevention is relatively small, and relative to the whole budget is actually becoming diminished.
I would like
that is a concern for I think for all of us.
Prevention. I mean, obviously, it would be a wise thing, but it's awfully hard to bring about because we solve problems rather than anticipate them, because anticipation takes money away from immediate needs. And that's why in this building it's difficult to say, why don't we set aside money for a long-term problem or put it here because it'll save money 10 years from now. You know, it's just a factor of government. But I'm wondering if there are any, or is there discussion of incentives to help people do more prevention. For instance, 20 years ago, before seatbelts were mandatory, I remember our insurance company said, we will double your PIP benefits if involved in a crash you happen to be wearing a seatbelt. And so, I mean, I understand math, and I said to all my kids, from now on you will be seatbelted because I get double the benefit and it doesn't cost me anymore. It was an incentive that made a lot of sense. Could there be incentives to increase benefits or make it more beneficial if a person who is receiving, of course I know we got Medicaid problems and waiver problems, but the idea is that if you go into the hospital and you have a blood test and you are free from alcohol or nicotine and other things that indicate a lifestyle that is not contributing to your problems, I'm just wondering if there's any discussion about incentives that might help people want to do better rather than just different benefits.
Mr. Chairman,
another issue, to be honest.
I have the same kind of automobile insurance that you have, and I know what you're talking about. We don't direct the provision of care in our finance programs in quite that level of detail, but partly the issue for us is that we need to make the programs that we have available. It's not just incentives, but we could certainly look at incentives. I'm just not prepared to do that.
That's
an interesting idea.
Policy issue, but prevention is all talk unless there's a reason to cause people who don't really want to improve. I mean, you know, they have addiction problems, and those are not easy to overcome. All right, let's
with respect to the
Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Barry, one of the point you brought up is a question we've asked ourselves now for 4 or 5 years. What is that question really is, what is the role of public health? And where do you cross line between what you want to do in public health and you start getting into the care of patients? You do pap smears and pelvic exams, breast exams, and screening exams at public health. Well, that takes away money from the true preventative programs, so, such as immunizations, make sure the water supply is safe, looking and helping with diseases that are important on a societal basis, whether it be tuberculosis or sexually transmitted diseases. And the slide is real difficult, back and forth. And I think you've been forced to fill a bit of a gap because of a lack of access to health care for low-income individuals. And I think that goes right back to what you were discussing earlier. And I think one of the things you need to do is ultimately decide where that line really is and what your mission really is and what business you want to be in, what business you want to get out of, and make sure that if you do get out of some of that business, that it's picked up somewhere else. And I think that's a real policy decision for public health that has not been answered yet. And I don't know if you're thinking about that or talking about that, or it's something that just kind of keeps sitting there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, yes, indeed, we're thinking about that. During the last interim, we had a very rigorous self-analysis, both at the local level and at the state level, of how we were fulfilling the responsibilities of a public health system. I talked with Dr. Allen about an assessment of the status of the health of Oregon and getting that information to you, because it will shape your future policy decisions, and then looking at what this public health system ought to be doing, where its gaps are, and how we would bring forward a comprehensive program. We've been in a very defensive mode for several years, and I think there is a lot of interest in public health. During the last session, it was reflected in critique of the department. I think we now see that there is a growing recognition that this is an area where we're going to need to do more work. And I think that the appointment of a public health director reflects that.
Yeah, I want to just follow up with one thing that Senator Bates said, and that is this idea of identification, because if public health is about prevention, like through immunization and so forth, and it really is becoming treatment, the future of that goes like this. I mean, the cost becomes huge, and you just look ahead 5 or 10 years from now, and public health will be a primary provider of services all across the state, and I mean much more than presently. And I think that it is an interesting and worthwhile discussion to see if that's the direction the department really wants to go in, or is that something that needs to be dealt with right now, you know, soon, and say we really do need to refocus on helping to prevent disease and those kinds of things and leave treatment for medical conditions to another part of the system. And see where that can go. You know.
Mr. Chairman, you're telling me that we're at a crossroads, and I think that we need to confront that.
Well, anyway.
I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. I mean, a primary care setting is an opportunity for prevention. And I think Senator Bates has identified a need to understand where that line is. And that's really where our investigation ought to take us. But we're not financing much of the care that I've been talking about. It's as you've pointed out, incentives are very powerful. And financing drives decision-making at the local level, simply because just to give you an example, in our communicable disease program, or in our local health departments, we provide them with about 60 cents per capita per month, compared, for example, to Washington State, which is about $4 per capita per month. And that hasn't gone up. In fact, it's gone down. So in the absence of general funds to maintain that system, what is the local health department to do? I mean, I think they make decisions based on sustaining the capacity there. And secondly, as bioterrorism has become a concern and there has been money available for health nurses in the local departments, federal funds have increasingly driven decisions at the local level. So those funds were supposed to be dual purpose, so those nurses could do communicable disease work, and then if there was an emergency, they would respond to that and coordinate and do all the exercises and drills. But there is an evolution happening here, and I think we need to understand it. If the state wants to have a public health policy, we can't have a public health policy. But increasingly it's driven by other decisions. I have run out of water, and I need a glass of water. If somebody could
help
me, I'd appreciate that very much. Let me move on, because I think we need to get to the budget issues that you wanted to discuss. We've done a number of things, of course, to contain costs, and we pursued drug rebates in the HIV program, where they're specifically authorized by federal law. But they have not made up the difference in resources, the gap that we're facing. And in those cuts that we've experienced in the past 3 or 4 years, totaling for health services about $900 million, have been mostly in the Oregon Health Plan and mostly in mental health. But public health has experienced some erosion as well, and I want to just put that on the record. Our tobacco control program was briefly eliminated and then reduced about 60% from the level it was at in the 2001-03 budget. Our toxicology program in public health systems...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
On that, I had asked a question earlier regarding the number of teens maybe using tobacco products now, because I know that there's been a big cut. Has there not in the education that we have provided in the past, in the school systems in particular, because we had to reduce the tobacco prevention programs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moniz Anderson, there has been a reduction in effort. When the 2003-05 budget included this reduction, some of the money went into a media program, which is an essential component of a tobacco control program. And the limited funds available for communities were offered on a competitive basis. And so there are still effective programs in some areas, and some areas don't have the programs that they used to have. You asked a question earlier, which I think is the critical question. Are we seeing a change in the curve? Are people smoking more? Is there a change in the consumption of tobacco? Are kids reporting more or less use? We're still seeing improvement with children. But we have a small... research base that can answer those questions, and annually they give us that data. We do the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey every 2 years, so I think that we can make it information available to answer your question much more specifically.
I just follow up. On at least on the media, it had said that now girls in particular are starting to use tobacco products more, and I just wanted to know if that was the same in Oregon, because I know in the 90s when we really started working hard on doing outreach into this education program, we actually saw a decrease in the use of tobacco products, and there was a reduction in the number of teens starting to smoke, and I'm just wondering, but that was in the late 90s, and I'm just wondering what it is now.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moniz Anderson, I can't give you that information today, but I'll make sure that Dr. Cohn and Dr. Allen bring something back so that you can have that information. I do want to say that there has been some research done on what happens when you cut a tobacco control program. California did this long before we did, and they did see a change in the trend line and then plateau and then a slight change in the wrong direction. So tobacco control is effective, and in its absence, there is a good deal of stimulation for the use of tobacco, although I can't give you the data today. We do have it.
We can.
Thank you. We
do? We have.
Yes. Dr. Allen's telling me that we have enough evidence now to say that there has been a change in the trend as a result of this change in funding.
Thank you.
So tobacco control was reduced 60%. Our toxicology program was reduced by $400,000 a year, and so we're almost solely working on specifically funded programs like beach monitoring and so forth. Our health planning component was reduced by $400,000. There was a slight reduction in our support for local health departments below 60 cents per capita. Our multicultural health program was reduced marginally. And several services were cut, restored, eliminated, restored again, things like juvenile diabetes, children's emergency medical services. The school-based health center program is eliminated and then restored. during this process. So there has been, I think, real ambivalence about the support the capacity to support these programs, and just bring that to your attention as part of the record. Without increase, I'll say unequivocally.
You're on record correctly saying that we may be making a mistake by not looking long term and assuring that there's funds for these important public programs, and it's the effect of politics. And I was just saying to Mr. Britton, it's very difficult to know how to take money from programs where there's immediate benefit and place it where there's long-term benefit that may be of much greater magnitude. And that's part of what we're confronted with here.
Mr. Chairman, I did hear your remark in February that it appeared to you that public health was one of those unequivocally governmental functions. And I can tell you that in Oregon, without the increased federal support from the bioterrorism program, we would have seen a dramatic shrinking in local capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Let me draw your attention to page 29. This is the BAM analyst recommended adjustment, and I don't want to go through all of them in detail, but there are two here that are particularly important. The first is the drinking water program. The drinking water program in the governor's recommended budget would experience a reduction in 3 staff and $200,000. Let me just give you a little background about what the problem here. In 2003, the department sponsored House Bill 2255, which would have established an annual public water system connection fee in order to respond to issues raised in a Secretary of State audit in 2001 that said we weren't delivering an effective, we weren't doing our full responsibilities under the federal law. Chair Jensen asked the stakeholders to work together to achieve a consensus and bring it back to this session, and that's what we did. The task force was asked to identify the department's workload to continue to administer the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act in Oregon. This is referred to as primacy. If we lose primacy, the federal government's going to be running our drinking water program, and I think everyone would agree that's not a good idea. Secondly, it was to identify the resources needed so that the department could assure that this work was getting done. And the task force worked and did achieve a consensus in April that the department should retain primacy, that it requires some additional resources, and that drinking water is a statewide responsibility for the department to be funded on a statewide basis. They recommended a solution, namely to increase existing fees to cover the full cost of doing the inspections. And those fees could be, of course, established by the mechanisms that are available to us and by rule and then subsequently ratified by the session. And to impose a new fee for service for sanitary review inspections. This is the area where we're only able to do these inspections, I think, every 5 years instead of the mandated 3. At any rate, the recommended solution was agreed to virtually by all members of the task force except one. Now, concurrent with the task force process was the budget process, which included a cut in the drinking water program, which was never fully reviewed in light of the department's commitment to the task force and to the charge from the legislature. So what you've got here is a task force that's bringing you forth a bill, and we have that in the session. I think it was a committee-introduced bill. To raise fees to complete these inspections, and a cut in the general fund, which in a sense violates the commitment to the task force because the task force doesn't want fee revenue supplanting the state's current effort. The department wants to keep its commitment. This cut slipped through, and I take full responsibility for that. We've made a commitment to the task force members and to the drinking water stakeholders that the department will manage this internally and retain the inspection program. And we expect to bring that forward in the reshoot. Drinking water, as everyone has an interest in safe drinking water. The second critical issue in this, on page 29, is the reduction in the family planning expansion program. And I want to answer the question that was addressed earlier. This cut of $1.6 million, as Mr. Britton pointed out, would reduce the program by about it would reduce the family planning expansion waivered services by about a third. Currently, our family planning services see about 136,000 people. About 100,000 of those are financed through this waiver. And this reduction would probably cut services to around 35,000 people. Virtually almost all of them are women. The November e-board...
Senator Wessels.
And what does that... when you say that, does that mean it, they actually provide services to a certain income level? What specific service are you talking about?
I'm going to do my best, and then if Dr. Bradley feels that I'm moving in the wrong direction, I'm going to ask her to come to the table and answer your question. But my understanding is that this makes people eligible for Medicaid-funded family planning services up to 185% of the federal poverty level. So it is an expansion population in that respect. And it has been a vastly successful program. And, in fact, in November, the Emergency Board added 600,000 in general funds because of caseload growth in the program. It's a very popular program. It does an effective job with fairly low state resources, since there's a match of 9-1 in the program. So here you have the e-board adding funds to the program on November, I think it's November 6th, and the budget went to press on November 15th or 16th, and the governor staff has indicated to me that this cut was an inadvertent result of the way in which this budget process was constructed, and that the governor was clear in December that it was his intention to keep the program whole. So we have a problem in this budget that we need to resolve, and we look to do that.
So you're saying that in the reshoot, this is going to be refunded?
That is under consideration, sir.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to this committee. This is the first time I served on it. How does the reshoot work in terms of we see various budget packages and we see cuts and these type things that we're all struggling with whether to support or... Does the reshoot, in effect, replace the governor's budget in this area? Or, Mr. Brennan, just how does the process fit?
The reshoot is our opportunity to kill the LFO analyzer that brings it to us if we don't like the number.
Excellent. The GRB taketh away, yeah, and the reshoot giveth back. And we have to balance the budget.
Similar to the book I read that I miss my ex-husband, but my aim's improving.
Yeah.
John.
Mr. Chair and members, the reshoot typically we will deal with in work sessions as we actually work this particular bill. And you'll see each adjustment related to the reshoot. The department will be here to talk to each of those. And we'll be here as well to give you some recommendations about the reshoot. So the reshoot is, in some respects, is like a rebalance, but into the future of the 05-07 budget, and could consist of corrections of problems. It will consist of new forecasts of caseloads. And in some instances, it may contain policy changes that the governor has heard the discussion around the Capitol about certain kinds of things, and he may or may not add things, may or may not cut other things. So it is a repricing of the governor's budget.
Thank you,
Chair. Senator Bates.
I think John's been incredibly humble about this. LFO does a wonderful job in helping us through this. This is a very complex budget. And the reshoot is extremely important. We can see major changes in a program and the funding sources for it and what that program costs as a result of the reshoot. It's our best estimate of the next 2 years, which over areas which are very difficult to look at. DHS will give us the best numbers they can. LFO will try to vet those numbers for us. And then we'll have to make decisions not just about money, but I think we'll be making decisions about some significant policy as a result of the revenue available to us and what we can do with that revenue. So we're waiting with great anticipation the reissue, because that really gives us something we can sink our teeth into and really decide what needs to be done and what our restrictions are and what we can and can't do. I'm not sure what the history of this usually is as far as time is concerned. I think this particular reshoot is taking a little more time than normal because we have so many unknowables for us. The Medicare Modernization Act, significant potential changes in caseload in seniors. Probably the most predictable part right now is the Oregon Health Plan because we have more people in managed care. But even there's questions of significant policy we have to decide based on the other revenues available to us. So from my point of view, at least, the reshoot is extremely important and really what's going to set our budget in this department to a great degree.
You know, that also includes should there be additional funding for public safety, because the truth is none of us know if we will be on this committee in 2 years. But we're here now. And if there are things that need to be faced, and there's time and there's enough clarity to do it, then we ought to look at it now, because 2 years from now, who knows what the mix will be. Anyway, we're anticipating the reshoot with great anxiety.
I think it's the right phrase, anxiety.
Just with one more comment with respect to this women and reproductive health program, Mr. Chairman, you were quite clear in February about your concerns about our key performance measure that addressed unintended pregnancies. And we have been working on addressing that key performance measure and how it's structured to remove from it the kinds of concerns that you expressed and I think Representative Hanna expressed. And rather than bring that forward here, I'd rather communicate that in writing to you so that we can take a look and work on that together in more detail. But I think we have a solution, and I think it will be satisfactory, but I'd like you to have an opportunity to evaluate it.
Thank you.
We have two policy packages. I've already alluded to the $500,000 proposal that the governor has made to expand school-based health centers to 5 additional counties. There are currently 3 counties that have advanced planning grants to prepare them to be fully certifiable for school-based health centers, and those are Coos, Jefferson, and I think Deschutes. And 2 additional communities would be funded. The funds are about $50,000 per county per year. The counties decide where these which schools are involved, and even in affluent areas such as Bend, there are outlying areas where there are serious problems in access to care. The polarity in Deschutes County, of course, being the southern county in Lapine. But in any case, we ask each community to develop that that plan themselves, and we can share that with you. But I think the concept here is to work with 5 additional counties, which would take us to 19 across the state.
We have limited funds, and so
I understand.
There's going to have to be justification as to it, other than the fact that they're on the list. And so if that justification isn't fully vetted and forthcoming, then you know there's going to be decisions made.
Right.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kast, how many of the school-based facilities are operational today?
At the time that the school-based health center program was eliminated, there were 44 schools funded. Do you know the answer to the question? I think there were a number that were cut and then have been restored, but we're not back up to the level that we were in 2001.
Follow up. Then
there are currently 43 school-based health centers in 14 counties.
Follow up
is could you provide us a list of those that are operational now? I know that during our back to school visits, and I may have mistakenly thought that in Lane County, Cottage Grove High School was one of the schools that had a school-based health center. I know the school was constructed with the space for one, and I did see the space for that center, but it's not in operation, and so I'd like to.
Lane County has 5 centers in North Eugene, Sheldon, South Eugene, Springfield, and Winston Churchill.
Okay.
I could say Churchill since I'm no school from sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do produce a report, the 2005 status report, which I think we provided to the committee, but I will make sure that you get a copy again.
Thank you.
For clarity.
Okay, thank you.
A second policy package, that's policy package 122, would for the school-based health centers. The second, we only have two. The second policy package, 139, is a fee increase in two areas, vital records and the physician visa waiver program. The waiver program permits the governor to designate up to 30 individuals who can fill needs in under-resourced areas. And we have, for example, used this program to make sure that we have psychiatrists at our Pendleton Psychiatric Hospital. The vital records fee is a little more complicated in that those fees hadn't been increased since 1991. We brought a fee proposal to the 2003 session. We were directed by the committee to implement those fees administratively. They affect nine staff positions in vital records, and to bring the fee back in a bill during this session. The fee was raised in an administrative rule from $15 to $20 per record and is addressed in 5039 under the Senate Bill 333 process. Now, the way the budget works is that because this fee was implemented by administrative rule, it is phased out in package 070 in the budget, and then package 139 buys it back. Vital Records, when they brought this fee forward 2 years ago, expected the fee to be sufficient for six or more years. Note that there is no general fund in our Vital Records office. All of the work we do there is supported by fees. So it's critical to us because we have nine staff people who respond to requests from the public. And I know, Mr. Chairman, you have posed at least one question to me about why it takes so long to get a birth record, and I hope we've answered that one and that particular incident satisfactorily. I think we are responsive. We do produce a good product for the public, but we have to have the resources, and the only source is through the fees. We've been asked what legislation is required to balance this budget in public health. The fee bill is one, and the second has already been addressed, and that is the redirection of the tobacco use reduction account from the prevention and education program to other parts of the budget. The GRB transfers part of this account to the general fund, and we have proposed language that would accomplish that. Now, Mr. Chairman, in light of your specific remarks earlier, I'm not sure how you want to proceed. I think in light of what you said, perhaps it's best to wait to look at the numbers for these programs until you have
4 minutes left, so we probably...
With 4 minutes left, I don't know what your preference is. I can ask Mr. Nickel to join us and get started. Or
well, let's see. First, committee members, are there questions that you'd like to address?
The format of drill of football is very appropriate, but not for this committee, sir.
Do you want to? Well, Mr. Nickel, if you want to come forward and just give us something to think about overnight, that would be fine. And we'll you start to see us packing up. It's because
we have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Since you've invited me to give you something to think about, and the question came up earlier about maintenance of effort, I think maybe in the few minutes that I have, I think that's an important contextual question for us to talk just a little bit about. The maintenance of effort issue is basically this, that in accepting two different federal block grants, one for mental health and one for addictions, we make a promise as a state that we'll maintain our general fund effort. And because of a whole series of cuts that have happened over the past couple of years, we are in difficulty right now with both of the federal grants that we have. We have already been determined to not have met the financial requirements. We have been given an opportunity, which we have taken full advantage of, to demonstrate that Oregon is in what is called by the feds material compliance, which means that in spite of the cuts, in essence, we were able to avoid loss of services to enough people that the feds would take that into consideration. Both of these federal grants, in my opinion, are in jeopardy right now, and the decision now rests with the with Mr. Leavitt, the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the federal level. The penalty on the alcohol and drug grant would be about $6.7 million. That's how much we missed the state general fund contribution requirement by. That would be a devastating.
Just one thing. Is there a history of the federal government making those cuts if they feel like there's not a full maintenance of effort?
Mr. Chair, yes, indeed there is. Massachusetts received a fairly significant penalty. Some other states have been able to be granted waivers. I think the problem for us is that we missed the financial mark by enough that they're having to review this very carefully. I've talked personally with the SAMHSA director, Mr. Charles Curie, and he's been very clear to me that if we are, by some good fortune, able to get these material compliance decisions made in our favor, we will not get consideration with the next request that we make. So I think that much is clear.
Okay, just a moment, Mr. Britt.
Bob, I know the hour is late here. How do we stack up with respect to maintenance of effort for the governor's budget?
Mr. Britton and Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I think that's an important question. I don't know, because the feds would probably reset the benchmark that our maintenance of effort requirement would be based on. I would say this, that any further cuts make this a more difficult process for it. And I can't give you a good assessment right now because we don't have the initial decision made about whether we'll be found in material compliance. I am concerned that we're found in material compliance. They may keep the benchmark fairly high still. And so we simply don't know the answer to that question right now.
Okay. All right. There's more that we could say, but let's save it for tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Those of you that want to come back tomorrow, that's fine. The rest of us will be here Monday. And so we'll adjourn until Monday. Thank you.
Has there been any discussion?